Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage. River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Right. For all you locked up abroad, banged up abroad fans out there, if you remember the episode Kuwait, Scott here lives just down the road from me. So he's come up today and we're going to do his story in more detail in the episode. So thanks for coming up, Scott.
You're welcome.
And what were you doing in Kuwait in the first place?
My father was hired out there in the organ transplant unit. So he was an immunologist.
The organ transplant unit, yeah. Of what?
For kidneys, livers, of the hospital out there.
In Kuwait.
Yeah, he set up with Dr. George Abuna. He set up the most successful organ transplant unit in the Middle East for its time.
Wow.
He was quite an intelligent guy, and he went out ahead of us. He actually left us, I believe, from my mother's story, left us, but then called back 6 months later. Called back about 6 months later and said to my mother, you know, he wanted us to go out. And I arrived and never looked back, but my mother and sisters arrived and then wanted to leave from the second they arrived. So
how long had you been out there?
I arrived when I was 11.
So you moved to Kuwait at age 11, yeah. From the UK?
Yeah, from Scotland.
From Scotland?
Yeah.
Okay.
From Edinburgh, yeah. I think the reason we got interested in the Middle East is a few years earlier, my father had been in quite a famous sort of attempted murder case. My father was a victim. And after he'd been seriously attacked, when he started to get better, he got sabbatical and we went to Tehran for 6 months, which was actually the most wonderful 6 months of my life. And I went to the Middle East. And that's, I think, where my dad first got to know people from the Middle East. So we'd spent some time in Tehran.
The murder case.
My father was one of the first people in Scotland to win money from the government for being assaulted. If somebody put a hammer through his head, basically.
Whoa, this was up in Scotland.
Yeah, it was a famous case at the time. He got a lot of compensation, but he changed.
It caused brain damage then?
It's difficult. People who've had head injuries in their family, realize that head injury is a very complex issue, and it changes people's personalities. So he kept his intelligence, but he changed his morality.
You said this was a famous case, that person murdered other people.
No, it's a famous case in the sense that it was the first case where my father managed to get compensation out of the Scottish government, gotcha. Which at the time, we ended up with a most fantastic flipping vintage car, and things like that. But it was a terrible evening, and I still remember the cop coming to my house and sitting on the stairs listening as they told me my father had been assaulted. And he drove to the hospital with part of his skull hanging out.
Oh!
Yeah. And he got there and he drove himself there. And they caught the people. Gordon McCracken and somebody else. He runs a restaurant in Scotland now, apparently. He doesn't know what damage he did, and I think he should still be in jail.
Was it a robbery? Was that the motivation?
Well, it was, but what saved his life was when he fell to the ground, he pulled his jacket over his head, and the hammer, this is how they caught him, the fibres from the hammer were in the jacket, and they threw the hammer away nearby. But he had £6 on him, but they never got any. The reason my father, it was in the meadows at the back of the hospital.
£6, $10, bloody
hell. They got nothing. But the reason they mugged him, well, he used to walk through the meadows at night, which are in the back of the hospital, to get to where he parked his car.
Yeah.
And so he had nice cars, but only because he did them up to sell them. Because it wasn't that well paid being a doctor. So he did this and did that. Anyway, so we ended up going to Tehran after that, sort of, I think, to try and bring the family together and things like that. It was wonderful. But then we came back, and a few years later, my dad just left, got up one morning and told my mother she was leaving to the Middle East, and it looked like he'd walked out. And then 6 months later, called us and said, well, come to Kuwait. So we arrived, and like I said, I never looked back, but my sisters and my mother hated every second, which is typical of a woman. Sorry.
How old were you then?
11.
When you started getting involved in drugs?
Well, in terms of drugs, I mean, you know, I find it very, not just the wording, you know, for example, you know, when you start drinking is a far more.
Well, drink's a drug?
Worst of all. I mean, I've done more stupid things than alcohol than I have on any other drug.
Most crime is committed under the influence of alcohol.
No, absolutely. The bad name that drugs are given, you know, and the name that they get away with, that is unbelievable. But, sorry, the question again?
How old are you when you started getting involved in drugs?
Well, I hated the taste of alcohol. My best friend did it and got alcohol poisoning. I fucking hated the taste of it. Absolutely hated it. Still do. That's why I drink only spirits, to cover up the thing. But I guess when I first got a chance to smoke hash, in the Middle East, what we first started was with pharmaceuticals, right? So it was like Artane. It was a drug for Parkinson's disease. It was an awful drug, fucking awful. I mean, you'd see burnt spiders in your bed. You'd be talking to people who weren't there. You'd be catching the bus on Friday night, and there was no bus for another 24 hours.
Some people like that.
Yeah, these were really awful, though. Your throat would dry out. You'd get like birdcage mouth, and it was awful. But that was the first when I got some of my American friends and I. So it was pharmaceutical drugs. But then when I first tried hash, I guess I must have been 15 or 16, and it was just something that, compared to alcohol, was much more easy to use and was helped you in bed a little bit. And there was nothing negative. I still don't see anything particularly negative about hashish or marijuana.
And what country were you in when you tried the hash?
Kuwait.
In Kuwait?
Yeah.
Did you know the penalties there?
I didn't. When you're young and stupid, as you know, maybe you're a bit older than me when you got in trouble, but I was really like, I just lived with my father at this stage. My mother had left, and my father was out with his girlfriends, and I just lived, and I was a very free human being, and I just lived my life doing it.
Sure, just a teenager on a foreign adventure.
Yeah, it was
invincible, not thinking about the consequences.
No, I mean, I went through some wild stuff out there. You know, I was I just had a really, really exciting, nothing hurtful of other people or anything, just a really exciting childhood. And you know, and it just all went terribly wrong. And it you know, for something that, you know, when you're locked up for a piece of hash the size of your hand for 5 years, and you're just like, fucking hell, why am I here? What's the real reason I'm here? This can't be the real reason. It's just so hypocritical. You know, there's nothing wrong with getting stoned. People have been using cannabinoids for years. You know, you cannot stop it.
I agree.
Total ignorance.
I'm writing a book actually called The War Against Weed right now. So it is. It's a hypocrisy. The government's in on it with the pharmaceutical companies and everything else.
It's terrible.
But going back to your story then, what wild stuff were you getting engaged in your late teens then?
Well, it was just like the same as every other young sort of Western-minded person was just enjoying themselves. Women.
Parties.
Alcohol, as you would know. You know, we didn't provide free drugs, but at the end of the day, you know, it was just being... cars, motorcycles, women, drugs, but it was nothing, no heroin, no cocaine, nothing like that. It was just hash, a bit of hash, and homemade alcohol and brewery, which is the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East was a party town. I mean, Kuwait was a serious party town. It really was, and it's how it should be.
So have you got, at this age then, have you got a community of steady party friends that are your age, that you're going out with and doing
things
with?
No, I lost most of my friends because I left the Middle East and I grew up there. And I don't have a particularly need for people that much. I've got my small family around me. I've got my work.
You're a lone wolf even as a teenager.
No, then I had loads of friends.
That's what I'm asking.
Sorry, I thought you were referring to now.
So chronologically of your story now. Mm-hmm. You've smoked some, you got the hash.
Why did I get arrested?
You're doing these wild, you're building up into this party scene. So you've got these regular teenage friends in Kuwait. Mm-hmm. And are they foreign nationals? Who are these people you're partying with?
Well, the people I got in trouble were ended up being locals. But But the expats, as we were mainly from India, England, you know, Sweden.
Yeah.
You know, just mainly. And we had some Arab friends. I had a lot of Arab friends.
Yeah.
But the people who I bought the hash off were Arabs. The person that I was getting the hash for were Arabs.
Yeah.
But my friends, in terms of the general scene out there, was if you couldn't walk, you'd drive. You know, because, you know, everyone drunk. I worked for one of the biggest alcohol importers in the Middle East.
Yeah.
I used to drive around with tins of ethanol that we would have blown the whole bloody place up if it had gone off. And that's what ethanol was. You import it to clean hospitals in the disguise that you're cleaning hospitals. So you get a cleaning contract with the hospital. Mm-hmm. But really what you're doing is you're importing ethanol to sell to the expatriates.
So where are you going to get high with your friends?
That often. This is the irony. It wasn't the irony. It was a really rare event.
Oh, it was a rare event.
It wasn't anything like your... Don't forget, I'm 51.
Yeah.
This is going back to 1989, you know? This is a long time ago, 88, 89. This is a long time ago. And, you know, just getting in the Middle East, just when you get... alcohol's easy. But getting your hands on hash was a bit more difficult. A bit more difficult. But, you know, it was a rare event until I found Ali. And Ali knew how to get... a supplier. Somebody knows where to get it. And he had a decent supply. So, I literally got caught on my, they knew on the first deal. I sold it to the same guy twice only once, right?
Who, let's explain who Ali is for the people who haven't seen the episode. Okay. Where did he pop up from?
Ali is a friend of mine. My friend used to dive down in an area called Ahmadiyya, or past Ahmadiyya. I forget what the name was. And they used to dive down there. And Ali worked in the oil refinery place down there. He was a really lovely man, actually. He'd given his kidney to his sister. Actually, because my dad was in the kidney transplant unit, so that was ironic. So he'd been involved in this person's life earlier on. So the question.
We're just giving the background as who Ali is.
He was just working there, and I knew him, and I asked him if I could get hash, and then I kind of put the two and two. So why did I get arrested? How did I get serious? Is a friend from school came back, a Kuwaiti friend called Nasser, came back from England boarding school and said, Scott, can you get some hash? I said, yeah. So I got some hash. We were just smoking together. This guy appears out of nowhere in the thing. His name's Talal. And he says, oh, Scott, this is my friend Talal. When I go back to boarding school, would you mind sorting it out? You know, so it was never me. I have to make, you know, it was never me saying, do you want drugs? It was somebody asking me, can you get me drugs? Right? So... that was the only reason, and the only reason I thought of doing it was because I thought, I'll buy my girlfriend a ticket, Lisa, to come out from Cyprus and do it. It'll help me pay for that. So they actually knew on the first deal, but they carried on, and he came to my house, this Talal, afterwards. So what happened was Nasser went back to boarding school. Talal calls me, can you get me? Can you get me? Can you get me? So I decide, I'll try and get you some hash. And so I went to his house, right? And there was actually CID in the next room at the time. And I went to his house. And he came to my house with a guy dressed up in a disaster. And I went to the kitchen with the guy. I said, Talal, what the fuck are you doing bringing someone to my house like that? And this is when you knew I know he was a coward. And I knew he, later on, because it all comes out later on, all he had to say to me then was, Scott, leave, get out. To be a man, all he had to say was, Scott, I've been busted. But he wasn't. He was a snitch. He was a through and through snitch. So he went, basically, that was a CID officer in my front room at that time, you know. So anyway, went away. So I went to his house, gave this stuff, and then they set me up on the second deal, which was the deal that I got busted. So in my eyes, and I think in a lot of people's eyes, it's in the West, it would be called entrapment.
Yeah.
If you ask somebody to provide you with drugs and you put, and they're incentivized, I got somebody who wants it. I know somebody who's got it. You know, and it's just, and at that age, you know, I really was, as the expression goes, young, dumb, and full of cum. You know, I was just really fucking stupid. You know, I was just wanted a good time. Didn't want to hurt anybody. Didn't want to poison anyone's life. It was hash, man. If you drink whiskey, you cannot complain about hash.
And how old are you now when these deals are going down with Talal?
Well, two deals in my life.
Yeah.
Only two deals. First deal, they knew what was going on. Second deal was the deal I got arrested. That's it. Yeah. There was no more. I was the worst drug dealer in history. I just talk about anything. I've got a mouth like this. Listen, this always gets me confused, but I think I was 19, 20, around that.
Basically, you're just a kid who's been framed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And at the time, though, a Kuwaiti had been arrested in London for something quite serious.
Yeah.
Right. So a rape of one of the royal families. There'd been a rape or something in London. And you tend to think when you're in that this was a response when you were trying to associate things with it, because a lot of the time they just let you, you know, if you're not white people get away with stuff, but there was a certain understanding of things. Yeah. Know, you know,
there's like a class system out there, isn't there?
Oh, very much. My God. It's slavery for Sri Lankans, for Bangladeshis, for it's modern day slavery, for Filipinos, for it's terrible. I mean, it's disgraceful. That's another topic, though. But yeah, I love Kuwait. Don't get me wrong. I love the place. But I was white, and my father was a doctor, and I was, you know, and we were treated in general very well, you know. But when you get the lower caste, you know, as I said, the Bangladeshis, the Sri Lankans, the Filipinos, you know, the maids, the domestic servants who were raped, and all the rest of it, you know, it's a terrible story. But the Middle East is a land of hypocrisy. Total hypocrisy, you know.
On the day of your arrest, then what happens then?
Okay, so that's going back a long time. So the day of my arrest, so I'd arranged to meet Talal with the second with the hash, and I'd given it. I'd not given it to him. We'd been at the house, you know. I told you the CID had been in there. I always get it confused.
So it's like the Criminal Investigation Department, similar to the UK with CID.
It was at CID level by now, but I'd been round. I always get the first time I dropped off, but I'd already been to the house and dropped hash off and stuff like that. But this was a second time.
Yeah.
And we were in my Trans Am, and I was with my friend called Nick, Slick Nick. We're sitting there, and I go around, and I said, Nick, take me around here. So we get in the park in this place round near our friend's house, and he turns up, and Talal turns up. And that was this is when they were supposed to arrest me at the time. Because, you know, I remember he got in the back of the car, he was nervous, he got out, and he was smoking a cigarette like a joint. And then he threw it like this. And literally, I said, Nick, let's get out of here.
That was the signal.
That was the signal to arrest us. But they didn't do it. They realized, I don't think they did it. It's because they wanted to come to where the women were. They wanted to come to the house. You know, so basically, I went about literally round two corners and went to a thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So by this stage, we're inside, we're drinking, we're smoking, women are there, guys, we're just fucking partying.
Yeah.
Just nothing, you know, nothing terrible, just a bit of music.
Yeah.
Then a knock on the door, and I'll never forget it. I got up and I walked around and I said, who is it? And he said, it's Talal. And as soon as he said his name, my fucking blood went ice cold, ice cold. He said, it's Talal. I said, what the fuck? Your mind's going, dude, you're stoned, you're drunk. Uh-oh. And the door came fucking flying in. And these five guys in dustaches with guns drawn, and they came in, and he said, oh, man. You know, and that was really the beginning of, you know, it just, that moment of my life has taken away from me any sense of security, any sense of things that, feeling peaceful about things, because you think at any moment it can all go.
Yeah.
And as you know, so you're aware, you know, so it takes away something from you. It also starts something in you. And what it started in me was my ability, my inability to never stop thinking.
Yeah.
I'm always fucking thinking. I cannot shut my mind. What's going on? What's this? What's this? And I was as free as a bird. I really was. I was as free as a bird. I was a good, kind human. You know, nothing wrong with me at all. I was just out there having a good time, and it all went terribly wrong. And it went, you know, but I met some fantastic people. I was in the fucking best jailbreak you've ever fucking been in, honestly.
Before the jailbreak, did they take you to the cop shop next?
Yeah. Okay. So yeah. So we're in the house, and by this stage, I mean, it was awful. So I'm in the room. I'd be taken separated in the room, and they're saying to me, so first he said to me, big guy says to me, Scott, where did you get the hash? And I thought, oh, fucking hell. Don't forget, Ali is in the same house with me, right? Yeah. So I've gone back to the house. Ali's there. I had on my mother's life, I had no idea I had given Ali marked money. I had no idea that the money I'd collected from the house was marked money. So I'm in the room, and he says to me, Scott, where'd you get the hash? And I said, I know this guy, and I call him, and there's a hole in the desert somewhere. And he goes and puts it there. I don't actually know what he looks like. And you know, this is what my mind said to me.
Yeah.
And he just said, Scott, where did you get? I said, I'm trying to tell you. And then he hit me.
Oh.
He hit me here. He was a big guy. There's a bed behind me. Fell on the bed. It was enough to scare you when you've got a guy 6'2", yeah, whatever. Yeah. And, you know, so I lay on, I was on the bed. I got up and go, fucking hell. And then he says, where'd you get the hash? But at this stage, they brought Ali in from outside. And he said to Ali something, Minwena Flusrukum, where is, or Hadanafar Andi Flusrukum, this guy has the marked money. And I, and Ali, in all credit to him, they asked him, did you give him the hash while I was laying on the bed? Or they asked him, you know, and he stopped my humiliation like that. He said, yes. And he said, yes. And he went through some terrible things after that. And then I walked out of the room and my friend Jenny was down the hallway and she'd had some hash in her drawer, the other half of the hash, and she was pointing at me. Luckily, I mean, her and her boyfriend, Paul, had fucking marijuana growing, but they didn't know what it looked like. And for growing marijuana, that was more of a sentence than what I'd done. Ooh. But they had marijuana growing in their room, little plants, but the cops didn't know it, which was really lucky. So they found this half in the underwear drawer. They were going around, there was tons of alcohol. They were finding hash thrown all over the house because everybody who had it was throwing it out of their pockets. But I said it was all mine. I said everything in the house. I was so humiliated by what I brought to my friends. You know, it was awful. But anyway, so they got all this alcohol. They made us load all this alcohol onto the back of this truck. And then they separate. And then they took me and Ali on our own. And we drove, and this was probably one of the scariest moments of my life. We drove back to Shuaik, which was an industrial area right near where I lived in Shuaik University. But there was an industrial area there, and I knew most of the police stations because I'd been in most of them for being chased on motorcycles. So I'd been in a lot of the jails, so I knew them all, off by heart. But I didn't know this one. And my friend, a guy called Kareem Coachman, had been found hanging a few years before. And none of us knew exactly how it happened or whatever, but we kind of believed something bad had gone on. And I said to them, where are you taking us? And the guy said to me, we're going to hang you. And they drove us into the back of this car. I'd never been in this police station. There were trees and stuff. And my friend had been hanging, and I was really scared then. That was a bad time. And then they took me upstairs and they handcuffed me to the bench, and they'd got some porn from the flat, and they all went to watch the porn next door. They all went to watch the porn next door. They enjoyed that. You know, so, but what was terrible, I mean, so this was the beginning, right? So this was the beginning. But so they had Ali, and they took Ali. And Ali, as I told you before, had one kidney removed because he'd given it to his sister. So they were punching him in the kidney. I didn't see this, but I knew it afterwards, because they wanted him to set up the next people in line, which was a guy called Saud and another guy called Daoud, I believe. They were two Bedouins. Real Bedouins. You won't believe how tough these guys are, seriously. They made Ali set these guys up at a fish market, right? And so Ali had to set them up, machine guns. Da, 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 da. So 2 days later, they arrive in the jail. By this time, Nick and Paul and all the other people who arrested me were now with me downstairs in the cell. And they were torturing Saud, and they're upstairs, right? They were torturing them, and then they came to get me, and they...
What methods of torture did they use?
I'll tell you, this is exactly what happened. So they're beating this. So they come and got me, and they took me into a room, and they lay you down, and they sit on your chest. This is like four men, so there are four men, you know, big men.
Yeah.
And then they take a cane, and they have a strap that hangs down off the bottom of the thing, and they put it under your knees. So you're lying on the floor at this stage. Put it under your knees, and one man holds it here, one man holds it here, and they have a selection of canes over in the corner, and the canes have tape on the end of them with drawing pins stuck in down the side. So they took me, and they laid me down, and I have really sensitive feet. Seriously, when I go to a beach, I'm going to go on my girlfriend's back to go over it, because my feet are, like, hypersensitive.
Yeah.
And they laid me down, and they pulled it back like this. And I'm like, you know, like I'm not a hero of any fucking shape or form. I'm not.
You're just a kid, man. I'm
serious. And then they all laugh. So that's one thing they did to get me. And the other thing they did to me is one morning they just woke me up. Said, don't worry, Scott, your dad's sorted it all. You're out. They took me out. They took my handcuffs off. They took me downstairs and they said, here. And then they said, whose car is that over there? I said, you know whose car that is. That's Ali's car, you know. They didn't search it very well. There was a gun underneath and a magnet. And then they just laughed at me and they put my handcuffs back on and took me back upstairs. So that carried on. But the worst, in terms of seeing the torture, we're hearing it. But then they called me up to the captain's office and I'm sitting here like this. And for example, the captain was there and they walked in with Saud. And he couldn't walk because his feet were so, they'd be beating him for days. The gaps in his feet, the cuts in his feet were as wide as that, right? His feet. So he couldn't walk. So he's hanging on to the guy, and the captain's asking him questions. And when he's lying, where'd you get that? I don't know. He's standing on his foot. And the shame I felt that I had brought this onto this man, right? It was appalling. The self-hatred I felt for what I'd done. But you know what? He didn't speak. They tortured him for days and days. And the only person to get out of the thing was the guy after Saud. It stopped. The chain stopped because he wouldn't speak. They had no evidence against Daoud. But you know what was so stupid? Is when they went to arrest them, you know, where's the hash? Where's the hash? Where's the hash? It was under a carpet in the tent. It was literally, all they had to do was lift it up and dig it, and they didn't find it. You know, so you got to laugh sometimes. But anyway, he didn't. So that all took place. We're going backwards and forwards to court. I have to admit to more than I've done because I'm so ashamed. So every bit of hash in the house, the prosecutor asked me, I'm like saying, no, it's all mine. When my mother eventually came out for the trial, they said to my mother, your son is a white knight. She said, why'd you say that? He says, because my God, yeah. But it was just out of shame. I thought, and you know what was ironic? Not ironic, but you know what was, with the first night I was arrested, and I said, he says, Scott, you're in trouble. You're in real trouble. I said, yeah, I guess that. And I said, so how long am I looking at? And they told me 25 years. I didn't tell you about the part. Also, they took me back to my dad's house. So after they told me they're going to hang me, they put me in a car with four officers, took the guns out next to me, showed they were loaded, closed the guns. So I'm sitting in a car with four big men, arrive at my house, and oh, the shame. I go at the front door and knock on my own front door. And my dad walks through with a disc drying cloth in his hand. And then they opened the door, and because the cop had been there, as I said, with Talal before, they took me straight into my bedroom, which was a bar. I had like a bar in my bedroom and all the rest of it. So they took me straight in there, and all I heard was my father going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, and I thought, fucking hell. I'm really... So yeah, so they, because they took all my father's booze, you know, I brought a lot of trouble on people, but not deliberately, you know, not with malice.
Like I said, you were just a kid. So are you in shock right now going through all this?
Yeah, I knew I was in trouble. When my dad came out, when he left the house after they'd taken everything from my dad's house, they came out. And my dad's not a very emotional sort of guy since the accident sort of thing. You know, I've never seen a tear in his eye in my whole life. He just hugged me and he said, Scott, I'm sorry. I don't think there's anything I can do.
Yeah.
And it was a nice hug. It was one of the only times in my life I've hugged my father. And it was nice, but it was a lonely feeling. And you know, when I drove away, the Arab guy next to me said to me, you know, if you were Arab, your father would have spat on you. And I just said, I'm not Arab. So I knew I was in trouble when my dad knew it was, but 25 years, I was just, as they're watching porn next door, giggling, you know. And then a couple of days later, Talal, the informer, walks in like he owns the place, wearing his little Navy uniform, and comes in and tells me all this bullshit story. But right now I'm, you know, I don't know what the hell's going on. You know, I don't know who to believe, what to believe. And he made out like it wasn't him. It was, but I know now, after adding everything up together, it was absolutely him.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing worse in this life than people who stitch other people up. You know, at the end of the day, if you ask somebody to get your hash, it's not them on the street corner saying, do you want some smack? You've asked me to get you a bit of hash because you're in a country that's so fucking hypocritical that you're not allowed, you know, it's ridiculous. You're the Arab, where's hash come from? You know, the best hash in the world, go to Egypt, man, smoke some good weed. You know, you know, that's another story. So, back at the jail, then I was taken back and they took our photos for Interpol and my friends all got out because of what I said and I was left alone.
You're taking the fall.
Yeah, but I deservedly, you know, it was my fault, but it wasn't all mine. Everybody else, I mean, they were smokers and stuff. They could have all got 2 years, 3 years or whatever. But so I went back to the main and I said goodbye to my friends. And then I went on the loneliest bus ride of my life.
Have you got to see a judge at any point?
But we'd seen a judge by now to make the cases. And so we'd been taken from the jail to the courtroom and we, you know, in a cage, you arrive in a, you know, taken up. And I had to admit, as I said, to all of it. So all my friends, suddenly after 10 days, all my friends, we've been moved to one police station and we're taking our photos, are taken for Interpol, and then all my friends leave. And it's just me and Ali. And I have to go to the central jail. And that was just a such a lonely journey to leave and to drive past your old school and head down into the desert and arrive at this place in the middle of fucking nowhere. And I know you talk about heat in Arizona. Is it Arizona?
Yeah, almost 50 degrees in the summer. It's funny though, because about what you just said there, I was transported from one prison to another, and they drove like past the city where I worked, and then they drove past the turnoff where my old house was up in the mountains. And then when we got to the prison, we could actually see where I used to live up in the mountains. So it was this constant reminder of my old life.
Yeah, you had a good life by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I did for a bit, had it going on. Yeah. So you're on this lonely bus journey.
Yeah. And then you arrive at jail. So Ali had quite a curly hair. So the first time I laughed when I got in jail was about 10 minutes after I arrived. And it was when we all went to get our hair cut.
Yeah.
You know, and I saw Ali's curly hair all come off and I giggled a bit. But then they took us into the, and this has to rate as the scariest moment of my life. So being taken into the block, and you've got cages all the way down in front of you, and it's all lit up, and you've got cages up above you. And as soon as we opened the door, everyone was running to see who had arrived, because they'd heard that loads of English people, because there were quite a few people arrested with me, right?
Yeah.
My friends were all arrested with me. And
yeah. You
know, as I said, they all got out, right? Yeah. So it's just me and Ali and Saud who arrived. So I was the one English person. And they were going, like, put him in my cell. And I was like, fucking hell. And I said to the guy in charge of the block, I said, can you just say to everybody, just make it really fucking clear, I'm not gay, all right? I'm not gay. And can you do me a favor? Can you put me in this block? And he spoke English, but he looked worse than the guy out of flipping the, what's that Turkish one, Midnight. Honestly, he was the ugliest guy you've ever seen. And I said, please put me in the cell with Ali.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin. It's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage, River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
Lowe's knows that free makes everything better. That's why our rewards members get free standard shipping on the things they need and want, starting at Silver Key status every day. Savings for rewards members add up fast, so why wait? Join for free today. Lowe's. We help. You save. Not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/shipping terms. Subject to change.
And he did. Yeah. But what I was going to figure out in the end, though, was that the, you know, what I knew in the end was I was in the drug and alcohol block. Yeah. We were all decent people. And the gun runners. We were just decent people. We weren't rapists. Yeah. We weren't thieves. We weren't anything. We were just decent people who liked to party like every fucking human does if they admit it. You know, who wants a life of sobriety and boredom and all the rest of it? We all, you know, as long as you don't hurt others, live and let live. But I didn't know that at that stage. Mm-hmm. You know, I was actually in a block with mostly decent people. But when they all came running down, and don't get me wrong, there were quite a few who wanted to have their way, so to speak, as you know, but I'm not gay, you know, but I wasn't going to be, if I was in the rapist block, I'd have been nervous.
How did you know some of them wanted their way with you?
Oh, that all came on later on. But I had many friends in the end, and when I was inside, so
was a lot of sex going on in the prison?
Yeah, no, our block, as I said, was normal. I mean, there were a few Filipinos or whatever that I think that might have
any ladyboys,
that sort of thing. I think that sort of thing, but it wasn't, you know, as I said, I'm not gay, and I'm not. I think what they used to do, as far as I'm aware, so you're given a bucket to wash in. Yeah, and you stand behind, you've got a little sheet. So what happened, I think the ladyboy sits and stands in the bucket.
Yeah.
So if the cop comes along and looks from beneath, mm-hmm. there's only one pair of feet.
Yeah.
That's what I heard anyway. Big feet. So that was scary. And I got put in the cell where the jail riot started. The actual at the end of it, where it all started, was block 5, cell 3. Third cell in on the right-hand side past the tuck shop. And that's where I got put that night. And that night it was freezing cold, don't forget. Now I'm now in November time, the desert's cold at night. and the lights never go off. I just remember lying there on my floor, on the floor, because there was no room. There was, everyone had a bed, but they were all pretty nice, the guys. And I just lay there and I look, and it's like a road. You look out on the cell, so you're on the cell, and then there's the cells over there, and it's like a road, it's just concrete. And this cop, and I just sat there, and I sat there, and I'm like, oh, God, what the fuck? And I'm a very impatient person, right? School, Monday to Friday, fucking hell. How long did a whole week seem? And I was like, 25 years, 25 years. My mind was going nuts. My mind was going nuts. And the lights never went off, and his feet went up and down, and I watched him. I don't think I went to the toilet for like 13 days or something. I was hoping I had bowel cancer or something like that, but I took it. They gave me a laxative, and, you know, I shat a python.
Was there any other English?
At that stage, no. There was a German, but he came later on. No, there was no English. It was all Arab. Arab, Lebanese, Iraqi, Afghani, Pakistani, Indian. Yeah, it was.
Did they look at you as someone from the West, possibly had money and try and get money out of you?
No, there was nothing. It wasn't, like I said, we were the drug and alcohol block. We were decent people. We're not criminals. we're not, even though we were the only criminals in the jail, because of George Bush's father's war on drugs at the time, that had everything removed. So no time off for good behavior, no time off for National Day. In National Day in Kuwait, the most you could spend in jail in Kuwait, right, unless you were dead, killed, was they gave you 25. Mm-hmm. But the most you can do is 10. Okay. So my friend did 10, right? One of the nicest men I ever met did 10 in there. But 10 years is what you'll spend maximum, right? So I got 5 years in first court, reduced to 3.5 in my appeal, and then 6 months for if you had a fine. And my father wasn't going to pay the fine because he was pissed off at me. So I was going to have to do 4 years, right? Which was equivalent to over 10 years, right? Just because of George's Bush war. It wasn't heroin. It was hashish.
Yeah.
You know, for anybody who's tried hashish, they know what I'm talking about. Yeah. It's hardly criminal.
Yeah, I've written about George H.W. Bush in one of my War on Drugs books and all the corruption. And yeah, he's a sick individual, was a sick individual. He died, didn't he?
Recently, I believe, yeah.
Yeah. So let me just, before we get to the riot then and that stuff, let me just ask you some general questions about the jail conditions and the atmosphere there.
Yeah.
How did you get fed?
Okay, so boiled meat and stuff arriving in. I mean, I didn't eat. That's why when I left, I was 55 kilos. My dad used to give me a bit of money, so I bought mangoes from the fruit market, which came once a week, chocolate milk, tuna. The food was just literally the joints boiled.
That's prison food or stuff you're buying?
Prison food. That was the prison
food. Prison food is boiled joints.
The joints of the elbow and stuff like that with bits of flesh on it. Yeah. It was horrible. But, you know, it wasn't, I don't want to in any way insinuate that it was, I'd rather have been there than an American jail. You know, I'd
no
have been
bread, no cheese, anything like that?
Yeah, in the tuck shop.
So like a commissary.
Yeah.
So you could spend how much?
Whatever you had.
Spend whatever you had?
Yeah.
And the commissary is run by the prison?
Well, yeah, by the guy I told you. Well, yeah, by the leader of the block and somebody else.
Yeah, I see.
Yeah.
And so, in terms of temperature then?
Yeah, that's what I mean, this is when I was talking about your Arizona thing. This is, everyone says to me, what was jail like? And I was like, oh my God.
The heat.
The fucking heat. I literally, so I had a concrete bed in there, and I had a little bit, after a while I got a mattress. So I'd lay this mattress out and I'd fill a bucket up, a normal big bucket this high off the ground, and I'd fill it with water and I'd soak my mattress with it. I wouldn't put a cut, I'd put the whole bucket of water on it, and I'd take my sheet and I'd stick it in there and I'd make a tent over me. And there's a fan up there, 13 seconds it used to take to go from one end to the other. And the lights are never off. And it's the one fan for over you. And it goes over. And then it comes back. And the lights never off. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, you go, Allahu Akbar, from the guy next door. You know, prayer, call to prayer at 3 o'clock in the morning. You go, fucking hell, what did I do to deserve this? You know, God Almighty, what did I do? It was just horrendous in terms of... the heat.
Did the heat cause you to, because where we were at, there was like a little vent attached to what's called a swamp cooler. And when it was working, the air coming out of it was like as warm as our breath. So you're in this confined building structure that heats up in the day and stays hot all night long. It's like a concrete oven, basically. So now we're getting these skin infections and bed sores, itch and bleed. At one point, it looked like I spilt battery acid on my leg. And because you sat around a lot as well, you're getting all these bed sores on your ass. But if you scratch yourself, because you're sweating constantly, your skin's turned soggy. So you got the itchiness, and then you scratch yourself, and clumps of your own skin are coming off under your nails.
It sounds worse than mine. No, I didn't have. I mean, I had a lot of the itchy, but the just the weight loss that I like I said, 55 kilos, and I'm not very big, but 55 kilos when I got out, you know, is because of the heat.
Yeah,
and the I tap because I've got nerve damage, I think.
What the tapping does is, we had another guy who tapped, and Joe had to spend hours trying to minimize it, because you get people on YouTube, especially if they put headphones on and listen to the podcast, it's really loud, the tapping.
I'm sorry.
We're going to get a reflexologist, I think, and when guests come in that room out there, we'll get the reflexologist to go over the feet, so calm the feet
my
down.
Wife calls me Mr. Tap sometimes. But I do apologize.
So, we're on the general conditions now. We're talking about the heat and the food. Mm-hmm. So you've got your fan.
I'll tell you a story. 13
seconds for the fan.
I'll tell you not an interesting, but funny. You can imagine it creates an atmosphere. It's a World Cup, right? Yeah. So there's one TV in the whole block, right? And we're watching it. So there's me sitting down with maybe 200 other prisoners, sitting there all on our ground, on our mats, and England score. It's England, Egypt. And I jump up. Yes! Yes! You know, fucking hell, yes! And then you can imagine, so I sit back down. Then Egypt score. Fucking hell. 300 people. Yes! and then we all got fucking sent to our rooms like children. And then we had to listen to it on the radio. I think we won 2-1 in the end. But that was a surreal experience of being the outsider. But another time I was watching TV, and this is when, so I had an Iraq and Republican Guard friends. His name was Nasser Zaghari. He'd been shot to the mouth, shot to the kneecap. He was a tough guy. I used to take the piss out of Saddam Hussein. I said, where is Saddam? I go to Saddam al-Arasik. And so al-Airi means on my dick, right? So I said, Saddam, where does he sit? He sits on my dick. He said, where? I got al-Airi. And he grabbed me like this, and he just touched my wrist, and I'd be in agony on the floor. He said, Scott, where does Saddam sit? I said, he sits on my head. I love him. Tough man. They used to tell me, that's in The Escape, I'll tell you about that. But the people, so I'm watching TV, and this is how sad it is. It's called Beauty and the Beast, right? It's like, it's a half decent show. It's called Beauty and the Beast. There I am, 21 years old, watching fucking Beauty and the Beast, Block 5. And I'm sitting there, and the law is, if one Arab wants an Arab channel, it doesn't matter if all the rest of the prisoners are watching something, the Arab can get up and change to the app. So this guy got up and he changed it. And we've got a bunch of Bedouins around a fire going, and they're clicking their fingers, you know, and they're doing that. And I go, fuck this. So I got up and I fucking hit the fucking TV. Within seconds, I had about three Bedouins. My jumper had been ripped off and I was stuck up against some bars. But then Nasser, the Iraqis who were friends of mine, right, within seconds, fucking up there, sorted it out. Thank you, guys. So, there were experiences. We had a jailbreak. The guy would literally dummies in the bed. It was actually one of the guys related to our case, I believe, if I look back. And he was caught a week later and they tortured him in front of us when they brought him back and hung him on the bars.
Was it the cane stuff they used to talk
about? No, they beat the shit out of them because they humiliated them. They literally got out over the roofs.
Yeah,
you know, past the gun towers and everything.
Yeah.
But they tortured them before they came back. But then they came back and they just basically handcuffed them to the cell and left them after they'd been severely beaten, and left them there hanging there to teach us a lesson. You know, so I'm sure you went through even worse. America's far more violent, but it all carried on and on and on, and by this stage I was with Lisa, the lady in the show. And we'd had it was a love story that all fell apart.
How did it begin with Lisa? Just explain to people who haven't seen your show.
Well, Lisa, it goes back a long, long way. Lisa goes back to Iraq. Lisa goes back to before jail, 11 years old, but she was too young then for me to do anything about it. But she left for a few years, went to Iraq, and then she came back and I knew at that stage that she was now a woman.
So you were kids together.
We were kids together. My best friend went out with her sister for years. They both just dropped me off here, actually. The sister's just over from Cyprus. So my best friend went out with her friend, and then they went to Iraq. She's actually met Saddam Hussein's son, my wife, Uday, the rapist, the murderer, the killer, the one who wrote about it. She went to his house. Luckily, she wasn't abused, probably because she was English. That didn't happen. But yeah, so I went to what happened with her is she came to visit, but she had a boyfriend and I found out she was no longer a virgin. So I was really interested. And she arrived as beautiful as ever. And I got together with her and then she went back to Baghdad. And I decided to her boyfriend. And I said I wanted to try and catch her or whatever you call it. So I got my friend to organize a visa, Dr. George Abuna, my dad's boss. The surgeon, the Iraqi surgeon, whose brother was high up in the Iraqi army, because the war was on with Iran, that got me a visa to Iraq, which was very difficult. But I didn't realize I arrived to fly to go and see her and to surprise her to go to Iraq. So I got this visa, thought I'll turn up on her doorstep, da 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 da. Went to the airport, but because of the war, you're supposed to be there 3 hours. I was a bit drunk as well, 3 hours before. So I arrived an hour before. You're not allowed on the flight because of security, because of the war. So I thought, what the fuck do I do? What the fuck do I do? So what I did is I got a taxi to the border, to the war zone, into Basra, and I traveled with returning soldiers up on the bus to Baghdad, went past all of the, honestly. And when you see men who've just come from a war and just seen the most terrible thing, you know, they weren't, like, there's an English guy, right? You can imagine, oh, well, there's an English guy on a bus. They weren't in the slightest bit interested. You know, they had just been through Basra. The Iraq-Iran war was horrific. It was horrific. And so anyway, I got to Baghdad and I that's how I got Lisa. I went to Baghdad and that's the love story began there. So I got her to leave her boyfriend and come to me. So we went to, going out with her, went to jail, got arrested. It's difficult. I wasn't a faithful person either. So she found out about my other girlfriends and stuff and decided that I wasn't worth waiting for. So we broke up a few months before the invasion. So, which was, you know, when you're in jail, it's a very hard thing. What I would say to people out there who are in jail, if you're going out with somebody who's in jail, be honest with them. If you're not waiting, don't lie. There's nothing wrong with going on with your life. There's nothing wrong with it. But if you are waiting, great, because you love somebody when you're in jail. You can love somebody. There's no drugs. There's no alcohol. There's nothing. You need people. And when you find out that is betrayed or whatever, it creates a pain so intense and so long and so painful that it's just be honest. If you can't wait, don't lie, is what I would say to people who are in the middle of going through long periods in jail and are in love with someone. You know, so I, you know, Lisa at this stage, we were writing every week, but I found out it was all sort of from my other girlfriend.
Are you getting visits?
Yeah. I'm getting visits. Oh my God, the visits. Because obviously the beautiful girls are turning up. And, you know, without being funny, you know what the Arabs are like. You know, it's all suppressed and all the rest of it. It's the most, because of their belief systems or whatever, it's the most sexually repressed area on earth. You know, it's all, you know, you can't have.
Is it causing resentment then that you're getting these beautiful women visiting you?
Oh, the captain of the jail tried to meet my girlfriends after work and all the rest of it. Yeah, to get, you know, I'll meet him, I'll take him letters, I'll take him this, I'll take him that.
So it worked to your advantage then? He was taking.
Yeah, he wanted to fuck my girlfriend, of course. Oh, you know, there's no fucking secret about it. It's the hypocrisy again. It all goes back to hypocrisy about hiding things and what's open and what's not. But they tried everything. But I managed to, my girlfriend Lisa managed to send me in a quite nice photo, and my friend who I'd made in jail, a guy I love to this day, a guy called Rahim. He is a murderer. I told you about the guy who did 10 years. He actually got done for other things in jail. He got put in a cell that you couldn't stand up or sit down in for 17 days. That was because of that was more to do with jail breaks and stuff like that. But why was I telling you about Rahim? I've lost my train of thought.
So you were talking about the staff and trying to take advantage of your girlfriend.
Yeah. So I got a photo and he'd never seen him. He got locked up because he was like 15, right? So, in Kuwait, you used to buy these flick knives, like one dinar, and they flick and they come straight out the end. And he'd come down from Iraq and all he'd done is got in a fight with his cousin and just gone like that, right? Taken to hospital and dies.
Died?
killed his cousin.
Into the heart, was it?
He killed his cousin with one stab. But it wasn't a militia. It wasn't an attack. It was a fight, right? An impulsive fight, which is actually the case of many murder cases. You know, it goes on to the Chinese murderer I escaped with. He did a similar sort of thing. But yeah, so Raheem, so I he'd never seen a woman before. So when I showed him a picture of my wife or my girlfriend in a G-string, it was. And then I also managed to get in a couple of like naked ladies in the photo, and I'll never forget it. So they, so it gets out that I've got these. The captain, the police find out that I've got this pawn somewhere. Right?
You're the pawn king.
No, only two photos, right? And they came to myself, and everybody used to. I had bags of letters because I wrote so much, and people wrote to me. That's why I don't write at all anymore. I just literally, and I had all these bags of letters. And the cop came to my cell, and he grabs my bag, right? And it's hilarious, and he fucking throws it over the cell. But I've got Christmas cards in there. So they all put musical Christmas cards. So they put jingle bells, jingle bells. And this guy's looking for pictures. And they're all, you know, the only reason they're looking for them isn't because they want to confiscate them. It's because they want to fucking wank over them. That's the fucking reason. And it's fucking true. It's true. It's true. You know, it's all, you know, anyway. So went through all the things that, you know, the jailbreak, the hanging people, because they used to hang and they hang people, they don't let you out in the morning. And
what are the offences that can get you hung?
Murder, but it tends to be only when they hang Kuwaitis or maybe Badoons, people without passport. They'll hide to hang a Kuwaiti. It's much easier to hang a Sri Lankan or a Bangladeshi or a Filipino. I mean, I used to try and go to the hangings in Kuwait. I used to collect all the pictures and all the papers from it. My dad finally said, "Dad, it's got, you can go to a hanging." So, yay! So I was like, you know, but I went the wrong fucking day. So it didn't work. But what happened was there were guys who'd killed an Iranian money changer and he did karate or something like that. So they had the Filipino or Thai ambassador there, I can't remember who it was, and he took 9 minutes to die because he was so light. And because when he fell, he didn't break his neck and because he was strong. So imagine in front of your local ambassador for 9 minutes, oh. You know, but they hang. I went to the gallows, actually, when I broke back into the jail after I got out, I went down to the gallows and I went down where all the dead people had been and I put my hand through it. That was an eerie thing.
Bloody hell.
Yeah. I've got a picture of that, actually. So going back to it. So I got 3.5 years, then 5 years down to 3.5 plus the thing. Everything's going on. Lost the love of my life, which was the most painful. So what happened was, I found out she wasn't waiting. And I almost went to solitary confinement, voluntary solitary, just to get it, because my mind was doing my head in. But then I had my, everyone says they, and I, listen, when I hear other people say it, I say, oh, fucking idiots, they're fucking stoned or this. But I had an experience, and I call it, the pain was so intense, and I couldn't talk, because just to write to her would take 3 weeks to get, 3 weeks for the letter to come back, right? And I couldn't stand everything that was going on. And I was, you know, the pressure was just like, just building and building and building. And I couldn't accept that this one thing that I had left, because I always had this vision of I'd leave, they'd deport me, and I'd have this beautiful woman waiting for me, and somehow I'd be able to rebuild something of my life. Because I, you know, I had a good life. I was, it all was going so terribly wrong. And then I got up and I went to the toilet. So in the cell, you've got a wall 2 or 3 feet high, and you've got all the other lights never off. So I just went to, and, you know, the Arabs definitely works. Shitting like an Arab is the way to do it. So I'm sitting there and I'm having a crap. And then I just start crying. And I just start crying and crying and crying. And literally rivers of water came out of my eyes. And I saw Lisa and I watched her walk away. And she turned and she walked away. And it all left. It was all the pressure and everything. I didn't care if I had to do every day of my sentence. I didn't care. I felt more. My dad said to me 2 months before the invasion, "How are you, son?" I said, "Dad, I'm happier than I've ever been in my life." I literally resigned. I'd literally resigned to the fact that I had nothing left. There was nothing waiting for me. There was nothing there. It was all fine. And I had to protect myself. I had to deal with it myself. I'd lost everything. All my friends had left, everything. It all gone from this glorious party to this desert shithole.
Did you feel detached from it at that epiphany?
I just felt the pressure, everything leave, and I put a shield around myself, and I just said I have to protect myself.
Because there was a period when I was initially incarcerated, I was pining for my old lifestyle, but I was missing, you know, girlfriend, everything, missing the drugs, missing the scene. Mm. But then in the second year, when they told me I was facing a huge sentence, and My girlfriend left me at this point, and I just stopped thinking about everything I wanted back. And I felt the sense of liberation. I felt so happy all of a sudden, like a mad monk in a cave.
You have to survive somehow.
And that was the turning point in my incarceration. Like you just said, you had this day where you're taking a crap, and all of a sudden this happens out of the blue.
Yeah.
And you have this vision of her coming in and going and going.
And saying goodbye. And basically, I said goodbye. I literally said, so to walk her, she'd turn around, looked at me, we looked at each other, and she just literally, I mean, it sounds corny, but walked off into the sunset. And my heart broke. I mean, my heart broke, literally, it shattered. But something happened, and I've had it twice in my, but I call it a spiritual experience. Yeah. It was just so, I literally, everything. I stopped smoking the next day. I started studying. I just wanted to just, it wasn't this anxiety thing anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe people say, oh, you become what's it, not indoctrinated, or you become acclimatized. Yeah, that's the word, sorry. Yeah, mm-hmm. Institutionalized. So maybe, but I don't think that was it. I just think it was just, I had one thing left that was keeping me wanting to my old life, which was Lisa. And when that left, I mean, you think it's bad enough, you lose your liberty, you lose this, but then you've got this one thing that seems to be waiting, and then you find out that's fucking bullshit as well. And the pain, I mean, fuck physical pain. You know, I've broken my arms a few times and stuff like that. You know, I've smashed this arm to bits. The pain of losing someone you love, when you're locked up, and especially if you've been in a relationship where you're writing and literally revealing your soul, is a difficult thing. Man, but
this is exactly the same. I'm just like, I can feel it. I was so heartbroken, and you can't show people you're crying. Mm. So I would be facing the wall, pretending to read a book, crying, so that the prisoners couldn't see that I wasn't making any noise, but it was just streaming down my face.
You learn how to cry in silence and wank in silence. Had a wank in a room with 13 people in there, right? Honestly, with the tent over there, and to come without fucking any...
Was that with the regular hand, or did you switch at some point?
No, well, I switched when I broke my arm, actually. Trying to wank with a cast on and not give yourself burned, I tell you, that's a skill in its
own
right.
And when you switched, was it like a whole new experience?
No, but hey, listen, in jail, they put bromide in your tea. I mean, I had pretty women coming to visit me. Yeah. That was the worst, though, to know, to see that they were out less than an hour's drive away, and you knew your girlfriend was out partying, and you were stuck in the fucking cell with the fan and the light and their fucking prayers. You know, everyone suddenly, when you get in jail, everyone's suddenly got a beard. They're all suddenly religious, and they all get religious in the hope that they convince the judge that they've found redemption, and they want the judge to give them such.
Yeah, that happens everywhere. Oh. There's in at the religious services, the front two rows, they are the ones that get the most religious, and they've got all the tats then of Jesus and Mary, all these tattoos.
Yeah. And then they go out and cut somebody's throat. I thought it said, "Thou shalt not kill." You know, I can't stand the hypocrisy of religious people. I can't stand it.
So just going back to these beautiful women visiting you then.
Yeah.
Could you get any action going with them under the table?
No comment. There's no. It wasn't a table. It wasn't a table. It's a room. It's a room with it's just a big outdoor room where you all sit like the Arabs do.
Yeah.
Which I sit on the floor. So you just sit there with your cross legs. But realistically, no. It's difficult. You might have seen the occasional side of a breast, or the occasional inside of an underwear or whatever, titillation. But it's you rely on your memories. I think your wank bank, as you rely on that, and you but the bromide in the tea.
What does the bromide in the tea do?
Oh, apparently it's because it's when you lock up a load of men.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know why they don't fucking make sperm banks in the fucking sewer pits of jails. You know, you don't need to go in and do it. I mean, it's just male frustration, isn't it?
So did you feel that the bromide cancelled out the testosterone effect?
I don't know. No, I've always been a bit of a wanker. I think like most kids, but in jail it was just keeping it sex in general. I mean, there were men who wanted to fuck me. I knew that. But, you know, so for example, like if they had a hash, my friend, this is Raheem, the guy that I told you about, the guy I'd love to meet again. And I've tried to find him again because I believe he got out to Australia. But I can't find him. I've written to his old address in Iraq and all the rest of it. Honestly, if you want to meet a man in your life, when he left, the whole jail got up and we were all, after 10 years, and we all clapped him as he walked out of the jail. And I cried my eyes out. You know, I cried my eyes out. He was a lovely man. So why was I telling you about him?
Well, we're on the subject of wanking. Did you guys do dick lifts?
Who?
Did you try dick lifts?
No. I'm rather private. I nicknamed my dick Badoon. It means without a name, as you get.
The old cons circulate these rumours among the new prisoners that if you spend so much time in prison, it's not going to work when you get out. Or if it does work, you're going to be a Minuteman. So apparently, if you do dick lifts, which is you go in the shower, get your dick hard, put a wet washcloth on your dick and then flex the love muscle so it goes like that, that's your reps. That keeps your apparatus.
Okay. I've never had any trouble with my apparatus. No. I've never. But I mean, again, going back to it, I wouldn't have felt comfortable if we were in the rapist block or anything like that. You know, I'd have felt more nervous there. But I, you know, we were, as I keep going back to say, we weren't criminals. We were the drug and alcohol block. But yeah, it all got the heat, like you, the heat was intense. What was bad about jail was the fucking heat. What was great about jail was the fantastic people I met, was the fucking break, the jail break. My story was told in Banged Up Abroad, Q8, Locked Up Abroad. And it was told well. It showed you a love story, showed you this. But where it really missed, where it really did not grasp the pure fucking excitement was the escape. The escape was phenomenal. The escape was just all of a sudden, imagine you're bored shitless, right? You've lost your girlfriend, the love of your life. Fucking the lights never go off. You've got Allahu Akbar next door. You've got the fan going on. And you go, fucking hell, what have I fucking done to deserve this, right? Honestly, yeah? What have I fucking done? Right? Yeah? You know, so where was I going to go with that?
You set the table for the escape.
Yeah, so it's all boring, right? It's really fucking boring. But I've had my epiphany, and I'm reasonably, like, I mean, I almost became a Buddhist. I almost became a Muslim. I was going to go to Afghanistan. I was going to do all these funny things because there was nothing else to do. I'd lost everything, right? Oh, well, why not just go and fucking shoot some Russians? You know, you know, that's how your mind, you know, yeah. So I'm lying. So there are FM radios, little like this, that we've managed to smuggle in. We're not supposed to have radios. But what you know about jail. Oh, okay. So. Let's take ourselves back. It's the 2nd of August, 1990, right? Which has become a very significant date in my life.
Yeah.
Okay, first of all, so don't forget. So I've no time off for good behavior. All the people who were going locked up when we were getting out because they'd have half their sentence caught up. I was having to do every minute of my sentence. And I had just lost the love of my life. But I'd had my epiphany. I'd come out of it. I was going to rebuild. I covered myself in a protective barrier, and I was going to survive. My dad had said, Scott, I'm going to Oman. I'm going to get a job. I said, don't worry, Dad. Just come and visit me once every 6 months. I'm fine. Don't worry about it. Go. And I told him, Dad, I'm happier than I've ever been before, right? Literally, I let go of the past and I accepted my destiny. So it's all there. So I had years to go. I'd done about 21 months. So I had another couple of years to go. Which, when you're young, if you think about a World Cup, how long it is between a World Cup, I was going to have to do the whole period. I used to find a week long from Monday to Thursday. And this is what's ironic, is that a lot of people who get in trouble for the first time.
Apartment people, my name is Dave, and I bring you good news. From Champion, River Park of Dublin, it's a brand new community now open and leasing. I've been to it. It's kitchen clean. And they've got a new enticement. You get 2 months free when you sign a 12-month or longer lease, and you move in by the beginning of October. Everything's new. New pool, new fitness center, free Starbucks coffee, EV charging stations, parking, garage, River Park of Dublin. Now make the move, literally. LiveWithChampion.com. Schedule a tour. LiveWithChampion.com.
A short, sharp shock should be, you know, with a sort of, okay, if you fall back, come back and do it. But all I needed was a week. All I needed was a month or three, just something to say, oh man, Scott, straighten up, this isn't right. But to dive deep in, and suddenly you've got years of being stuck in a room and in a block, years, your mind just can't handle it. you know, sleeping pill. I thought, okay, I'll get into sleeping pills. So at least I can sleep half the sentence away, but you couldn't get them all the time. I got into reading. I read so many great books.
Which ones are your favorites?
Leon Uris, Exodus. You should read about the foundation of the state of Israel, Long Live Israel. And I would say from the other aspect would be the greatest book I ever read was called The Forgotten Soldier by Guy Sager. It's about a German-French guy who fought in the German army in the Second World War in the Wehrmacht. Incredible book. From Here to Eternity. The Quran is quite hard to read. Very hard to read, actually. So I read a lot. I read a lot to try and I met lots of people from different cultures, different areas. So, it's all sitting there, and we're hearing these things about Iraq, and I wish you'd fucking come. Yeah, come on, Saddam. You know, but no, we're all sitting. But then I'm in bed, and I'm lying there, and normally in the morning, so we survive on big blocks of ice that come to our block, that go into our coolers for the salad and for the water to keep it cool. And then you get tea with bromide coming through the door, right? So you get that. So these are the normal noises, right, that make you sleep. So you get used to jail. Mm-hmm. You get used to the lights not off. You get used to people waking up and going to work. But when they're hanging people or something else going wrong, all the noises stop. So I'm lying in my bed, and then I hear them all talking. I'm lying in my bed, and they're all talking. And I just like, because, you know, you don't want to wake up because it's just more time. You want to sleep. Sleep's fantastic. You dream. You have this. Wake up. I listen to him. I said, Ali, what's up? He said, he's come. I said, what? He said, he's come. I said, fuck off. And I thought, oh. I got up, put my radio on. At precisely 2 o'clock this morning, 100,000 Iraqi troops have crossed the water. Ding! And the main invasion route is less than a mile, probably half a mile. Kuwait's small, right? The main invasion route is literally the next road down. Oh, right. It's the main ring road that goes straight up to Mutla Ridge and straight up to the border with Basra, the same border that I'd been to go and see my girlfriend in Baghdad. So, but they went past the jail. But by this stage, right now, imagine the fear, right? So you're thinking, and I start thinking English, yeah, is that a good thing or a bad thing? Maybe it's not a good thing. So every time you hear the block open, you're thinking, who the fuck is it? So we've all got our mirrors out the doors, as you know, you would know, looking, who the fuck is that? Who the fuck is that? No ice is coming. No water is coming. No food is coming. Nobody's been there. Just fucking nothing. So every time the door goes, who is it? Then they came around and said, give us your radios. But they were too scared to open the doors. You can sense the change. When power changes, you can sense it. And the power, and they were there. So my job, we had like 3 FM radios. We were just listening to it. So listen to the radios. But no ice was delivered. Things getting hotter. 2nd of August, right? Fucking hot. I mean, I don't know. I always get it wrong in terms of Fahrenheit or centigrade, but 120 and 100% humidity.
In the 40s.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, it was just getting so serious. And so then it took about 2 or 3 days for the escape to happen. You know, and so that we're in the block. And the evening falls, and you start to hear people wailing. The Arabs are quite good at wailing. You know, they wail, and then letting things on fire and letting it out. So you're lighting up the courtyards with fire to let the police know everything. Things are changing, but we're waiting to see who's coming. We're waiting to, and we've got no water, no ice, everything, no food. Da 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 da. And it goes on and it goes on, and it just the tension just starts to build and build. And build it. It was so fucking exciting, you know. And then we thought, okay, what can we do? So by this stage, people are trying. Okay, let's try and break out. How do we break out? You know. And so okay, so everyone's trying to kick their cells, right? So we got 3 of us. 1, 2, 3, kick. And I got like ankles like a chicken, and it hurt. And we didn't even make the thing move, right? But they caught me at Heathrow Airport. They actually got me at Heathrow when I came back. They said, How did you get out? And I was really anxious, and you know, I was 55 kilos, no hair, all the rest of it. I said, the guy downstairs had big legs. And it's true. The same block that I was in, block 5, cell 3 on the right-hand side, was where the jail riot started. And he had legs literally like tree trunks. He was a fucking huge bloke. And he'd kick the block. And the block had fallen off the inside, the block of the thing. And he'd used that as a hammer. And they came around all of us. And they let us all out. So suddenly, right, we're out of our cells. And you know something's changed because everything's, you know, the fucking cells have been destroyed. But they're still in charge of the jail. Okay. So we're now in the block and we're free in the block. We've broken into the store, free ice creams, da 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 da. But now we're the real men come into this. So this is when the real men, not me, the real men come into it. And that is how, who has the balls to kick the fucking door off the hinges at the front of the block? You know the cops have got guns and you know they're in charge of the rest of the jail, right? But they did. They did. Within fucking minutes, they broke out the front of the jail. This is our block. The whole riot started in our block. And this was the move that I didn't quite understand at the time until now, until later on, is that we had a terrorist group that had tried, actually, they'd blown up the French embassy behind my school. The cover at the time had fallen off and hit my friend on the head. I was going out with the Turkish ambassador's daughter at the time. And they went to her house thinking they'd blown up her house, but it was the American embassy around the corner they'd blown up. So the guy who had tied these bombs together, right, his name is Elias, right? But so they'd all had the death sentence for years, right? And they'd be kept, and we used to watch them. He had a limp and he'd walk and he had so much charisma and we'd watch him in the, and they'd had the, and they would, why don't they just fucking kill him? I'd think, why don't they kill him? And I found out later, but the reason they didn't kill him, right, was because Terry Waite, do you know Terry Waite?
Yeah.
So Terry Waite was in prison in Lebanon, kidnapped in Lebanon. And it was known, and I spoke to Terry Waite about this after I got out of jail. I called him on CNN. I said, is it true? It was known that if these guys were killed, Terry would be killed the next day. And the reason it wasn't, and the reason Terry got out was these people. So we went straight from our block, straight to their block, and they were Shia, right? They're Shia, which, who knows, it's worse than Protestant Catholic. It's like 50 times worse. So they're, i.e. the division between the Sunni and the Shia. But they're loyal to their tribe. And so they let out these prisoners. And now this is when all hell started to break loose. So as soon as they got the political prisoners out, they went straight to the workshop and started making Molotov cocktails, right? To bomb the Kuwaitis it was unreal. This is how exciting it got. I was like, wow, just wow.
Oh, you know,
there
God.
I am. There I am, a little old fucking the most useless drug dealer in history. And here I am in Midnight Express fucking, and it just got better and better and better. honestly, so this is going on, and I can't tell you if it was 2 days or 3 days. I can't tell you. I don't know how many days it was, right? They broke in to get the political prisoners out. I broke into the ice cream store. I was trying to get a suntan. They were getting shot at. Anyway, one evening I'm outside with my Iraqi friend and I'm sitting there and a bullet came. So I'm here on a wall and the bullet hit the wall over there. It couldn't have hit me. It hit there, And as the bullet hit the wall, I jumped. I fucking hell. And he was smoking a cigarette. He was smoking a cigarette, literally. And it didn't even go light and dark. And I put it down. I said, doesn't it make you nervous? He said, Scott, when your time is here, your time is here. He said, when I was in the Iraqi army and fighting in against the Iranians, we had Iraqi-made Kalashnikovs. He said, and after you fired one magazine, because the metal was such poor quality, you could watch the bullet land about. So they have a different attitude. But so at the same time, I see Elias. I look around and I see this charismatic terrorist with one leg shorter than the other, directing people up onto the roof with the Molotov cocktails. It just got, and by this time, they're burning all the file room down, right? They're burning all the file room down and there's smoke everywhere. So we're in the hallway, you can't see 5 foot in front of you. The cops have turned the power off, so there's no power anymore. But there's 1,000 prisoners by now, right? Roaming the jails, destroying burning all the files down.
Oh my God.
So getting towards the end now. So I'm back at my block. Block five's at the back of the jail, nearly. So you had block five, block six, and the political prisoners. And whenever they walked them around, the political prisoners, so they'd all have their bands up, they'd be walking with hands on shoulders. So all hell's kicking off. And suddenly, I'm at the back of the prison like this, and there's a hallway, all the smoke from the fire. And suddenly there are hundreds of prisoners running down through the smoke in a stampede, right? And what the fuck is it? And I see one of them is a guy from my cell called Nasser. He's a breakdancer from Saudi Arabia. He's a little 19-year-old kid. He's got a body like you can't believe. He can just fucking do anything. Right? And he comes back and I go to his cell and he's white. He's as white as I was. He's just completely white. I said, what fucking happened, Nasser? He said, shit, man. We were just at the front of the jail and they got up, the guy next to him, and they were throwing stones at the front by this time. So they had the gun towers, but they're at the front of the jail. He said, the guy got up and threw it and got shot through the head and dropped dead in front of him. Right, so this is why the stampede had come back, right? So we're all back, and so now you've got two dead people. I don't know how the other guy died. I think the block six guy was killed by prisoners, actually, because he was an informer. But So we don't know what to do, right? We're back. It's really nerve-wracking. Who's coming next? Is it the Iraqi army? Is it this? Is it that? And what actually happened was, which is ironic, is a father came for his son. So we're all sitting there at the back of, and so there's like 1,000 prisoners now at the back of the jail, right? All because people got shot in the front. All, as soon as guns come out, things change, right? People get, oh, that's not such a good idea. So it's dead bodies at the front. But some men are fucking fearless. Honestly, they are fucking fearless. They're just, if that's my destiny. But then what happened? He says, Ya Shabab, Ashotiyarua. Young men, the police have gone. And my friend is a Turkish guy. He'd been given 25 years for smuggling heroin, right? He had to go back to Turkey and suffer the same sentence. I saw him on the bars like this. Yes, you should have seen it. And then my friend comes up to me and says, Scott, can you take this Chinese? The Chinese guy used to wash my clothes. He was like a little Mr. T. He was like 5 foot, fucking like muscles, like very tough. Whatever. Once he'd been, because he used to wash for people. So he's washing the dishes and these Afghanis had come in, right? So he's washing dishes for everybody and they're going for prayer. And they spat all over his desk. He took the fucking thing, right? He took the fucking thing. He's only a little guy. And these Afghanis, I mean, huge, great big Afghani, crawled out of the bathroom. Right? He fucking smacked this fucking board around his head, cracked his head open, and he crawled out the fucking bathroom. So a tough little guy.
What was the Chinese guy in for?
Murder. Because he'd, again, drinking on a... He'd never seen Kuwait City. Laborer comes in. They're taken like slaves out into the desert. They live in these prefab huts. And they just had a bit to drink, you know, smuggling. Got, you know, as a gambling, you fucking, you cheat, stabbed and died. Lovely guy, actually. But he'd never been anywhere, right? He'd never been anywhere in Kuwait. But I'm a very, like, you know, I'm a good person. And he said, can you help this guy? Can you take him? I said, yeah, no problem. So now we know somebody's coming from the outside to get his son. I've got a Chinese murderer. I've got Ali. And we've got this thing. So, you know, it's now the 4th of August or whatever day it is. And it's all happening. We're breaking out. And I can't remember exactly what it was. It was the front of the jail and we get out. And I had my opium T-shirt. I was 55 kilos. I was green. I had my Turkish trousers on, my opium T-shirt inside out. And I ran out into the desert. And I turned around and I looked back at the jail. And there were hundreds of prisoners. There was prisoners in wheelchairs trying to push them through soft sand. I said, fucking hell, you've got some loyalty there. And you've got hundreds of prisoners running to the women's jail for whatever purpose, I don't know. But I ran because somebody knew nearby. Ali had a friend nearby. And we ran to a douanier. It's called like an outdoor house, a douanier. And we sat there. And I spoke to Ali. I said, Ali, what are we going to do? And I'd always hitchhiked all my life. I knew how to hit. I said, Ali, we're going to separate. And I said goodbye to my... I did see Ali later before he died, actually. But I said goodbye to Ali, and we then got my Chinese murderer, and I headed up to the motorway, to the main invasion route, which was literally, as I told you earlier, we'd crossed over and we were in this douanier, walked back to the motorway, and it was the main invasion route. All the tanks were coming in. I was fucking going, yeah. And I was hitchhiking, and a Sudanese family stopped, and I got in the back with the Sudanese family, and I had this little black kid in my arms, who was sitting in my lap. And we must have looked really weird, a Chinese murderer, a sort of English-looking, Palestinian-looking dude. And we went through an Iraqi police check. I thought, oh, well, fucked here. They let me go through. And I thought my dad was in Oman because he'd gone for a job. I thought, I didn't realize he was in the country. So I went to my best friend's mother's house, went down the motorway. They were coming off the motorway the wrong way because of the invasion. And I got back to my friend's mother's house and I got the Chinese guy taken back to the embassy. And I got a personal thanks from the Chinese ambassador for getting him. So then I'm out of jail and the invasion. And now, so suddenly in 3 days, I've gone from facing years in jail to suddenly I'm out of jail. That's when the nightmares start. Every morning you're waking up, they've withdrawn. I've got to walk. I've got to hand myself back in. What am I going to do? The stress was unreal. But I met some friends. I got a Saab 9000 Turbo within a day from my friend's father because we were out of the country. And then I went through, I went with a photographer who got stuff in Time magazine. I went up through a flushing out movement. I found out my dad was still in the country, right? So I said, George, let's go and film down near the ports. They invaded in through Shuaik Port, was one of the places the Iraqis first came in through. I said, let's go. And so we're driving in a Suzuki Jeep, right? So once you're driving on a road, if suddenly there's a fucking tank and machine guns going on, so I'm literally driving by and this Mustang, a Kuwaiti Mustang, a guy, a Kuwaiti kid in a Mustang, pulled up in front of us, slammed the brakes on, jumped out and ran to the house with an M16 in his hand. So this was the resistance. By this time we'd driven past them. There's stuff on fire. And I'm going, oh, fuck. I took my T-shirt off and I put the seat back like this. And I was hanging my T-shirt out the window like this. And as I went down under the flyover, there were 3 or 4 tanks and a couple of 100 Iraqi troops coming through to come in because there was resistance here. And we literally drove in front of the tanks. It was the scariest moment, honestly, like this. And then we got to traffic lights. And what did we do? We stopped. So there was an Iraqi sentry at the traffic lights. And I had apple juice with me. And I said to him, Tebi Asir, do you want juice? That. So he didn't want it. Anyway, so I went to see my dad and I saw my dad that way. So that was exciting. But then I know we're probably getting towards the end of our time. I guess what the two things that make the story a bit crazier than that is, one, I broke back into the jail a week later.
Why?
This is a good question, actually. I went back to get letters and the Quran, believe it or not, somebody had given me. I went back to get letters and that was really eerie. Because they were removing the bodies from the guys who got killed at the time. They just removed them. But I went I got a photo of the brain juice, you know, on the floor where they'd left them because they'd shot and it all gone onto the floor. So I got a picture of his brains or the blood from his brains. That's when I went to the gallows. And I went into the gallows and my friend looked over the top and I went down there. Then I went back to my cell. And
What was in the gallows at that point?
Well, I've always been fascinated with death. It was nothing. There was no rope, but it was the doors, the trap door. So I went down where the bodies would hang and I went into it and I was moving my arm. My friend put his head over the top like that and I took his photo, but it was eerie. And I went down to the block, the jail block, and all the water had been left on. So all the water's pouring off the side. All the watermelons were rotting. The file room was still burning. And I still got the letters and I still got the Quran and I still got the bits I went back for. And then I had a premonition that we should leave the country soon. And I told my dad this. He wanted to leave the next day. But I said, by this time, I had a hot-wired 7.2-liter Bedouin truck. It was the best truck I've ever fucking had. It was fantastic. My friend had told me where it was, and we'd hot-wired it. And so we met in a convoy. And guess where we met? We met up near the fucking jail. Yes. Where did you want to meet before we escaped? Oh, let's go to Kuwait Central Jail, because it was out through the desert. So we went up to the jail. And I had a gay guy next to me. And another guy, the last thing you want when you're escaping through a war zone is somebody who's quite anxious. So anyway, we escaped. And I was the first person to get to the border because I had a 7.2-liter Bedouin truck and I was having fun. I mean, can you imagine? Locked up in a cell, suddenly you're flying through the desert, you know, with tanks and everything, and you're trying to get to the border. And I got to the border. I'd never seen the border before. And I thought, oh, this must be it. So I slammed the brakes on and I ran up the sand berm. So what the border is actually a huge berm that goes down like that. And I ran up to the side and I threw myself down and I saw this camera going by on a Humvee opposite. That's Saudi Arabia. It has to be the Americans and the Saudis, you know. So we knew we were at Saudi Arabia. Got into Saudi Arabia, got into a town, but my dad's wife, who was kind of like she was a bit of a high-class prostitute. She was a very attractive Korean lady. And we're in the middle of a Saudi town and she's wearing a miniskirt. And, oh, man, all hell kicked off. And my dad almost lost it. And I just said, no, dude, I knew things by now. I said, no, let's leave. Leave, leave, leave. So we rushed out of that town and slept in the desert. And that's when I slept in the desert at night. Everybody had gone on to sleep. And I was on my dad's blazer. And I felt safe for the first time. I knew I wasn't going back to jail. And I lay there and the sky opened itself and it went from one star to 10 million stars. It was the clearest night I'd ever seen. And I said to myself, one, I want Lisa back. And two is I'll never take so much shit from anybody in a job or anything that I won't just walk away. I'll keep my self-respect. And the Lisa side of it, I got to Bahrain and I called her up. She was with her new boyfriend by then. I just said, listen, if you ever want to try it again, I love you and I'd love to be together. And came back to England. And it was even worse than being in jail. Coming back when you get out of jail, first of all, it's when you've nothing. I felt the most useless human. Useless human. And she came back to me when I had nothing.
Fantastic.
I was 55 kilos. I'd lost all my looks. I was reasonably, you know, okay looking before I went to jail. And I came out, I was like a fucking Biafran. You know,
how old were you when you came out?
23.
Wow.
23. So
how many years did you actually serve?
I did 21 months.
21 months, yeah.
So it's not that, I mean, you don't need, I mean, you know, it all becomes pointless after a certain amount of time. You know, it really does. It's okay, fine. Rapists, yeah, fucking lock them up for life. You know, people who break birth, people who break into private homes, things like that. Fucking whip them till they fucking can't stand up. You know, bollocks. There's certain crimes, you know, but drugs is stupid. I can walk out of here now and get any fucking drug I want within half an hour. The fact the government doesn't tax it, the fact the government doesn't tax and educate is idiotic.
It is. I agree entirely.
It's idiotic. The damage, I mean, I don't know. I haven't looked up to this day what damage could actually happen from the drugs I've taken. I think if a child is taught that, and understand and shown pictures of dead and so what can happen. But how can you, when tens of thousands die from this every year and two die from ecstasy, how can you ban one? No, as a human, as a logical human, you can't.
It's moral relativism. Mm. So how did you win her back?
I think it was because we had a, because of all the letters, I don't know. She came back. I think it's because of what we had. I mean, we married. We've got two beautiful kids. We've, you know, people look at our relationship now, believe it or not. And I mean, all my friends' relationships are formed by the wayside. Everybody's fucking divorced. You know, I'm one of the only people I know who's not fucking divorced. I can't tell you that. You have to ask her that, really. I mean, I went back. She came back to me. It's difficult to get over the things I know that we've done to each other. It's very difficult to get over. But at the same time, you've got to say to yourself, well, she came back. You know. So I think what I say to people who are locked up and feel useless and all the rest of it is that try and find some self-confidence. Try and realize that, you know, crime and spending, I dread the thought of going back to jail. I fucking dread it. You know, don't think of it as an option. You know, think of it as a time to turn it around. And, you know, you can turn it around. You know, I've had months where I've earned 40 grand. You know, and all I am is I'm a failed, the worst drug dealer in history, lost everything. You can use it as a stepping stone. And if you're not a criminal in your heart, you know, doing things that hurt other people never brings happiness.
How did you reestablish yourself into the work world?
I went back to the Middle East again. I went back to Dubai and Abu Dhabi and got involved. I'm a salesman. I don't know if you can tell.
Have you even been to Kuwait?
Yeah, I went back to Kuwait, actually, yeah.
An outstanding warrant for escape?
No, we all got amnesties.
You all got amnesties?
Yeah, apart from the murderers, I believe. I believe. Because the Iraqis destroyed all of the identity cards, and they literally went to the fucking identity card office.
Yeah.
And Kuwait was one of the first countries in the world that made you have identity cards.
Yeah.
The Iraqis drove a tank up to it and fucking blew it to bits. Yay!
So Saddam Hussein did you a favor.
Well, Saddam Hussein al-Arasik. Yeah, that's what I mean. Saddam set me free. He set me free. And I know a lot about the Middle East, but look, I mean, we all criticize him, but the only thing that can hold Middle Eastern countries together, ones that try to follow the doctrine of Islam, is a strong man.
Yeah.
The only thing. They can't deal with it. The madness of the religion mm-hmm. tears the society to bits unless you have a strong man.
Yeah.
They can't do it. I mean, it's terrible when you see how capable the Arabs are, mm-hmm. how capable the Pakistanis are, how capable the Indians are, and all of this darkness that envelops them and now envelops us.
I think the viewers of your Bang Abroad episode are probably wondering what you've done with yourself since the episode.
Yeah, well, I've had a family. I work for myself. I live in England, which used to be a society of free speech and free thought, which is no longer. I live in a left-wing lunatic asylum.
It's nice down there, though, down the road from me, isn't it?
I love England, but I don't like what's becoming of it. I don't like political correctness. I think it's absurd. I can't stand it. You know, at the end of the day, you know, I've got Pakistani friends, and they used to go to work. They said "gura chut," means you white cunt, and I say, fuck off, you packy bastard. That is how life is in general. People. Birds of a feather flock together. Yeah. It isn't, you know, it isn't.
It's the thought police, isn't it? The government.
Oh, I can't stand
Orwellian.
It. It's terrible. Yeah. No, but it's terrible because what they're supporting, what they're trying to do is to stop you. You can't say anything in this world right now.
And a cautioning note as well to young people, backpackers around the world might be watching this, thinking about doing something like what you've done. What's your message to them?
Get a bar job. You know, get a bar job. Just experience is everything. Money is nothing. I was just trying to get my girlfriend out. You know, use drugs. Don't make money off drugs. Use drugs. When you make money off drugs, as you're aware, there's repercussions, you know, that suddenly become really serious. You know, doing time is a waste of life, a complete and utter waste of life. Be kind, be honest, be straightforward. All of the things that, you know, don't follow Islam would be my recommendation. You know, when you look at all the radicalization that's going on, it's not the answer. The answer is to accept everybody and anyone and not to force your ideas onto other people, is what I would say. From what I've learned from living in an indoctrinated society to living what was a free society, which is now becoming a society of thought police.
I'm going to put Scott's episode, his Bang Abroad episode, in the description box below this video. And if you've enjoyed the story, please put a comment. Let us know how you felt about this. Really appreciate you coming down. I mean, this was the fucking, honestly, this has got to be one of the craziest prison stories I've heard. War zone, escape. I mean, you've got absolutely everything there. Hey.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.